Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, this is neither Chuck nor Julie. This is Mark Poff. I guest host for him occasionally. And yes, I am sick. If you're used to hearing my voice, I actually probably have a better radio voice now than I normally do. But I'd already committed to doing this podcast for Chuck and Julie. And I tell you, I really like doing podcasts for them. My point is, I don't want them to be burned out. I don't want them to feel like they have to do all these podcasts and maybe they get to the point where they make a decision that they don't want to do it, because I love listening in all the time. A lot of times as an analyst now working for defense attorneys, I can sit here and listen to their show or watch their show while I'm still doing analysis work. So I love listening into their show. I find it very entertaining. I love Chuck and Julie. I've known them for years, even back during their KNUS days, and loved coming on their show there. So I love guest hosting for them. I love doing it for me. It's a nice change of taste. It would have been nice if I was feeling good. I got done testifying down in Tucson in Superior Court in Arizona on Wednesday. Went most of the day. I testified for hours. If anyone's ever testified in court, it's brutal. And I'm used to testifying 2 to 3 hours at a time, multiple times. And I don't care how many times you've done it. When I walk off that stand, I am mentally drained. And then I started feeling sick a little after that. And then, of course, the day I have to fly, you know, I was kind of looking forward to just coming home and chilling, started feeling worse. I get home to DIA. And what do I have to do? I have to dig my car out because it's piled up in snow. So by the time I got home last night, I was in pretty bad shape. And of course, my wife wouldn't get near me because she's like, you've got the COVID. And basically, I would have been isolated all night and all day, except I had meetings today. So I'm going on my last leg here, but I'm going to make it. After this, I'm probably going to pass out shortly after this. You'll be seeing me drinking my hot tea, and hopefully I can make it for the next hour. And I'm going to talk a little bit political at first, because my partner, John St. Augustine, who hopefully is either connected or will be here shortly, I'm just going to have to make stuff up until he gets here. We're going to talk about some multiple cases. And I have to tell you, I'm real interested in the Baldwin case, you know, that they just announced yesterday that he is going to be charged. And we can talk about that, John and I, because we've had people that have been charged for accidents. I mean, it happens. And that's how it works. So I can explain all that. But one of the things I just got to comment on, and I'm not a political analyst, and I normally stay out of politics, but this whole debt limit thing, what a bluff. I mean, both sides are basically just, you know, are we going to let this train crash? And I'm interested to see, you know, it seems like there's always drama. You know, a few weeks ago, they passed a budget for next year. You think, oh, okay, that takes care of that, even though we don't like it because they're wasting all of our taxpayer dollars. But then all of a sudden, now there's the debt limit. And we saw how the Republicans during the nomination of the Speaker of the House pretty much laid out, we want a more conservative agenda, which I'm sure a lot of conservatives want that more conservative agenda. And, you know, I find it interesting as a complete novice to this. This is not my area of expertise. My area of expertise is actually in computer forensics and other stuff like that. So, you know, I just noticed that light's just stand by 1 second. That light's going to bother me the whole time, so I'm going to turn that off. First issue with the podcast. But, you know, back during the Trump administration, we didn't hear too much about debt limits and stuff. But then during a Democrat agenda, now the Republicans are bringing it up. The only thing that I, from a neutral, not neutral, I'm not neutral, from a bystander point of view is, I want my Republican cohorts, or whatever you want to call them, representatives, I want them representing a conservative agenda from beginning to end. And I was an elected official for 12 years. I was on a school board. We could not spend beyond what we made that year. Now, that's not completely true. We had to have a balanced budget, but you can build up reserves for special things, rainy day kind of stuff. And there was one or two years during my 12 years that we actually had to spend some of that rainy day money. But basically from year to year, you got to stay within your budget. We have to stay within our budget. So why is all this madness? And I don't care if it's Republican, Democrats, or whatever. They need to just stop. They need to stop with spending more than they have. They need to reel this in, and they need to all agree that we'll have balanced budgets in 10 years and stick to it. So that they need to do this. And so I don't know how I feel about the Republicans kind of holding on to the whole debt limit and saying that they're not going to increase it and see how this plays out. I don't know enough to make a good decision on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing or whatever. Sounds like an interesting concept to me to kind of bring the administration back. And then you hear John Pierre, whatever her name is, who doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Just ask the DOJ. Don't ask me questions. You know, talking about no negotiation. Well, I got news for you. Politics is negotiations. And I've always said when I was on the school board, there's nothing wrong with compromising so long as you don't compromise your principles. So they need to start compromising or start negotiating about this debt limit. But I don't really know the ramifications of that. What's going to happen if we start defaulting? It'd be kind of interesting to see what really would take place. I've never defaulted on a loan, so why should the government? But hey, they're spending a lot more than I am. So that's kind of my novice thing on this whole stupid debt limit thing. I kind of wish the Republicans would hold the line. We need to stop with this stupid debt, keep increasing it. And also these classified documents. This is an area that I actually can speak on. Before I went into law enforcement, I actually did government work when I worked for Digital Equipment Corporation and some other companies. I actually worked on some top secret projects where we worked with some crypto gear. And whenever you have crypto gear, they provide you with documents on how it works. So you can program and use this crypto gear and how it works. And these are highly secure documents that are in a secure area with secured safes. And the thing that's interesting is we would track every document. And we'd make sure that if somebody took a document out of there, that document was back. So we had that ability that, hey, we're short a document. And you had to sign them out, sign them in, and all this stuff. So we tracked every document. So my confusion is, here you hear about, you know, Donald Trump taking a bunch of classified documents with him. Okay, I get it. Can he or can't he not declassify them? That's an argument for somebody else. Don't care. But now you have Joe Biden. And they try to make it sound as if what Joe Biden did wasn't nearly as bad as Trump. And I'm going back saying, really? You found classified documents from way back when he was vice president. I mean, that's what they're telling us. So for 4 years, where were these documents when he was not a member of anything? He was not in government for 4 years, but yet he had these classified documents. He does not have the ability to declassify anything as vice president. At least that's what I'm understanding. And he secured them next to his Corvette. Now, I like his Corvette. Don't ever knock me. I have a Corvette. I love his 67 Corvette. I would love to have his Corvette. I would trade with him. But when you see that picture with all those just documents laying in the corner and him saying, oh, it's secured in my garage, that's totally irrelevant. My question is, when we're going to ask the government, every time they get a briefing, because I heard that, you know, during election periods that the FBI and different groups would go give these briefings. If you're dealing with classified documents, if I was ultimately responsible, I would want to make sure that these things were turned in at the end of the day. It's like, I don't want these things. I don't want anything to do with these classified documents. And how ironic. It's kind of like somebody calling out saying, hey, they're having an affair. And then guess what? You find out that they're having an affair. And no, I'm not the mayor of New Orleans, so we can talk about her later. But you got to, you know, that whole statement about throwing stones in a glass house is definitely the case. Because, I mean, I think this is more embarrassing for him than it is for Trump. Because Trump actually has the statement that he can declassify anything. And they were secured at one location. But that's another argument for someone else. My bottom line is they need to all pay. And also, here's the deal. If there's an issue, what about Hillary Clinton? I mean, my goodness, what she did was completely over the edge, if you want to call it that, over the line. And yet nothing happened to her, and she destroyed evidence. If that was one of our cases, we'd charge him with, you know, destruction of evidence, evidence tampering, which is a felony in the state of Colorado. But you're never going to see Hillary come up in this again. But I bet you have no issues with her stepping up and saying, oh, yeah, what Donald Trump did was terrible. So for me, it's just all ironic. I hope the House starts passing all kinds of stuff. Don't worry about the Senate. Just start passing all of these very conservative agendas. And let's rock and roll and see where the chips fall and vote on things and then just see how the votes come down. So that's it for me. I'm not a big political guy, so I'm done. So now we're going to bring on, if you could, Don, bring on John St. Augustine. If you could bring him into the mix, I see that he's part of the equation. And John, if you could unmute and turn your video on. So that's the end of it. We can't talk politics now. But all right. So.
What's up, Mark?
All right, John, it's good to see you, buddy. I like my background better than yours. Your background's pretty boring.
I know.
And we are monitoring the comments on the right. So if you want to ask any questions about some of these cases that we're working on, I'll read them to John. I don't think he's monitoring that, but I am. So ask any questions that you want, and we'll be more than happy to answer them. I love the Baldwin case. I got to talk about that first, even though the Idaho case is probably a lot more interesting. And I tried to look it up, but I ran out of time. I've been so busy today. And so I'm going to ask you, but I can't remember. So as they say, as an attorney, don't ever ask a question you don't know the answer to. I know that we had a shooting up at the shooting range up on Rampart Range Road years ago. And I'm trying to remember, did we charge that person who ended up shooting and killing somebody else?
We did not.
We did not. Okay. So, I shouldn't have asked a question I didn't know the answer to. But understand, in Colorado, now Idaho is going to be a little bit different.
Actually, New Mexico.
Not Idaho. How about New Mexico? I'm going the wrong way here, man. My brain is all over the place. So down in New Mexico, their laws are going to be similar to Colorado. So you have first-degree murder. Everyone's familiar with first-degree murder. That's when you intentionally, after deliberation, with intent, you kill somebody. You planned it out. You killed them. He's not being charged with first-degree murder. Second-degree murder, you knowingly killed someone. Yep. So I pulled a gun and I shot someone knowing, hey, if you shoot somebody, it's a good chance they're going to die. So he's not charged with that either. Then we have something called manslaughter in the state of Colorado. With manslaughter, it's a reckless act. And that's like if I pulled a gun out and I started twirling it, and it went off, that would be pretty stupid, especially if you were to twirl a semi-automatic gun, if somebody knows that. No, we're not monitoring your content like Facebook. But if you're twirling a semi-automatic weapon, it's going to go off, especially if it's a Glock, because it has safe action and the safety's on the trigger. So if you were to shot and kill somebody by twirling a gun, you're going to get charged with manslaughter. Then we have something even below that that's called
criminal negligent.
Criminally negligent homicide, which is sometimes you can charge people for not doing something that they should be. And I'll give you an example. Occasionally, definitely during my career, we had women that would have children and they're so tired after having children, and I get it, that, you know, they'll be breastfeeding their child on the bed and then they'll fall asleep and then roll over on the child and kill the child. It happens. That, in theory, would be criminally negligent homicide, or leaving your drugs out and your young kids get drugs. What do all babies do? They grab those drugs and they put it in their mouth. So that would be criminally negligent homicide. He's being charged, if I remember correctly, with involuntary manslaughter in New Mexico, I think.
Yeah, I don't know the charge.
Either way, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because what he did was reckless. And here's what I find so interesting. And I hear this on Greg Gutfeld on The Five, where he talks about they should have NRA safety officers at all these shoots or at all these filming. I agree completely. These are the experts when it comes to safety. And of course, they're not going to do that because they're the liberal media. And by God, they're not going to pay money to an NRA expert. So they hire this young girl who's freaking clueless. I mean, she's not an expert at all. And here's some of the issues. Someone asked what is a very interesting question is, how did the live rounds ever get on the set? Damn good question. Never should have happened. some of the individuals that were working that film crew were going out between, I want to say shootings, between filming, and they were loading these weapons that they were using on the set with live ammo, and they were target shooting, like after they were done, you know, cutting film for the day and stuff. So somebody allowed live ammunition on the set. And I actually looked into some information on this. There's three types of bullets that they use. He was using a revolver. So there's some scenes when he's pulling that revolver, someone's going to be watching that movie. And if you don't actually load bullets in there, they're going to say, look, that's so fake, man. There's no bullets in that revolver. So they actually have dummy rounds that do look like bullets. But if you shake them, they'll make a noise. They put like a couple BBs in there, but no gunpowder. So, and there's no firing. What's it called? Not a firing pin, but whatever. They're, whatever that is that sets off the bullet. It's not there. So you can pull the trigger all you want. There's no gunpowder. That lead's not going anywhere. But you shake them to know that it's empty. There's no gunpowder. So if you're pulling out a gun at the camera, you don't have to worry about this. Now, they're going to be arguing, well, that's what those bullets were. We thought they were, well, you know what? They should have been shaking the bullets. And plus, me personally, I don't know about you, John. I don't care what I'm doing. I can't point a gun at somebody. You know, you're going to have to do your filming in such a way, whether you have a remote camera over here, which they have the technology to do this. And then, you know, I'm aiming at the camera, but there's no one behind the camera. They have the technology now. They don't have to look in that little thing. They have little monitors that they can look at. So there was no reason for anyone to be behind that camera. So everything about that was stupid. No safety officer.
Right. That's critical. Yeah. I mean, you know, sorry to interrupt you, Mark, but
yeah,
I mean, as I'm just hearing you talk, I mean, you know, how many times have we done simulation firing at, you know, at a training facility? And, you know, the big thing on that is what you have somebody who uses a dummy weapon, right? You don't use any real live weapons. We have, you know, simunitions that if we're going to have simunitions, it looks like a real gun, but it's not a real gun, right? But even on top of that, like you said, there's a safety person that's there to check everything before people even walk on set, or in our case, walk right into a facility, that there is absolutely no real guns on the grounds. And so, you know, I've got to imagine as many times as, you know, there's film, you know, films involving gun, you know, guns going off or gun, you know, some kind of gun battle, that somebody's got to be checking that and having, you know, a safety officer there. It's not just the armor, right? That's right there. You got to have a secondary person there that is making sure that there is absolutely not a chance that a live round makes it on the set, period.
Well, there shouldn't even been there. And there's a great question. So they have dead rounds and a gun with no pin. That's actually not true in this case. The gun that they used was a live gun. It was an actual gun that would work because they were using it in between filming to do target practice with it. So they brought the live rounds on the sound set or whatever you want to call it. And then you have this young lady who was hired. Does she have the authority? I mean, you know, she's in her 20s. She should have said, oh, hell no, not on my set. You're not bringing. But I wonder how much authority she really had, you know, and I don't know. I mean, she was definitely over her head, but she should have been screaming. And then you had multiple people who quit, who walked off the set and said, this is dangerous. I don't know. That's a clue.
Right. But, you know, and I guess what I would look at, you know, and I was looking, when I was looking off to the side, Mark, he was charged with involuntary manslaughter.
Right.
Right. But you have to ask yourself, like, you know, when you're talking about this, as you were saying, right, there's a reckless part of the manslaughter statute. Yes. Was it reckless that somebody died, unfortunately, on a set of a show? Absolutely. Sure. But you have to look at what was his role in this whole thing, right? So, you know, I've got to imagine that the actual show or the actual studio has some kind of policy and procedure as to how they handle weapons during, you know, during a set, right? Like,
but understand this.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Actually, that's not. I hate when people say that. I intentionally interrupted you. A lot of these studios aren't the ones actually doing the filming. They all have these independent you know, like Baldwin is the producer, which means that he wants to make all the money, and then they distribute through these different distributors and studios or whatever. So he, it's actually Baldwin, if I understand this correctly, he's the money man. He's the guy behind all this. So he'd be the one who would set up these procedures, you know, and, you know, and you go back years ago, Brandon Lee, you know, was killed by a live round, if I remember right. And so you got to have that safety officer, but you got to follow protocol. And I find it very ironic. Individuals making these, you know, liberals making these movies don't understand gun safety. If you mention that every student in middle school should have to go through gun safety training, they would lose their minds. Well, guess what? That's the way it was 50, 60 years ago. They had shooting clubs at high schools. Their heads would.
Yeah, but as you know, as,
they're all
as
safe.
But as it pertains to this, I, you know, the way I look at it, if I were to be, you know, asked to investigate this, what you got to look at is who all had a chance to handle that weapon. When was that weapon brought, introduced into the set, into the studio? Who brought it in there? Who handled it from the moment that whoever brought it in, who handled it from that? Is it the armor? Who is it that handles that weapon? And at what point does it make its way into the hands of Baldwin, right? Yeah. If you can show that there was all of these steps taken to ensure that there was not a live round, then I question why he was charged. I almost feel, Mark, I mean, you know, this particular shooting has gotten so much, you know, so much publicity that it's like, who's going to take responsibility for her death? Yes, he did pull the trigger, right? But if you look at the context of when he pulled that trigger, it was during a shooting of a show. Now, why was she in that shot? Because it wasn't like one of the actresses, it was like the actual camera person. So is that what was supposed to be done? Like the gun was supposed to be directed at the camera?
Because
if it was, then, you know, again, right? I mean, right. Homicide. What does that mean? Taking the life of another. Right. And then you get into
definitely a homicide.
Right. It's definitely a homicide. But the question is, you know, was it an involuntary manslaughter on behalf of Baldwin? Again, I don't know a lot about the facts of this case, but just on the surface of what I've heard, you know, it's very difficult for me to say that he somehow knew that there was a live round in there. And to say that he was negligent, I mean, I guess the negligence is, look, it wasn't like they weren't filming a movie. They were filming a movie or filming
a show. Which had accidents. Baldwin is also the producer.
Right.
So it's his job to make sure it's safe.
Is it his job, though?
There were some issues. They'd had some accidental discharges with live rounds earlier.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you hand me a gun and I'm going to point it at somebody. And Baldwin, you know, he's making statements that he'd never pull the trigger of a gun pointed at someone. Well, he obviously lied because he did.
Yeah, but I think the key thing there, what you're saying is, yeah, but the key thing you're saying there, Mark, is that if there was prior incidences where there was negligence, then absolutely he should be charged. If this was a first-time deal, I'm not sure how you can point the finger at any one individual. I think there's a series of people that handled this weapon, and all of them in some way hold responsibility.
And they were charged. Three people were charged. I think Barney wants to say something. Barney, jump in there, buddy. Oh, am I wrong?
Yeah, you know what? The ass clown that was behind the gun is responsible. Mark, do you just take your gun and start dry firing it? No, you open it. You pull the slide back. You make sure it's empty. I would like to see Baldwin charged. He's not going to get convicted, mainly because he's been 100%, 1,000% ass clown since his early days of acting. But the fact is, if that gun's in your head, wait a minute, cut. I got to check the gun. You check that gun 10 flipping times. And believe me, a blank round is way different than a real cartridge with a real slug in it. So no, this guy needs to go down. He's not going to, but no, you don't fire a gun. I don't care where you're playing with your gun on the right, wherever. You don't pull the trigger and point it at anything other than the target without checking it
right
several times. I don't know what to tell you. You constantly check it. You just don't do that. But I guess when you're an actor and you're not living in the real world, Maybe that's how they do it. But
well, they don't. I don't think they train them appropriately. John and I have both had shooting training through law enforcement. And if you go to ranges, they're going to tell you the four range rules. You know, never point the gun at anything you want to destroy. Keep your finger off the trigger until you want to shoot it. Be aware of your target and beyond. And I can't remember the last one, but yeah, if you always adhere to the four range rules, no one's going to get killed. And
well, go back to your comment about NRA. We all had it in high school. There wasn't a kid in the parking lot that didn't have a 30-30 Winchester in his window or a single or double barrel Harrington and Richardson shotgun at high school. Everybody had them. Everybody did hunter safety. I did it.
Yeah,
I think I was 10 years old. I don't, whatever grade you're in then.
I know.
Everybody did it, and it wasn't really. Sorry, did I lose you?
Well, no, the problem is you're breaking in and out, Barney, so no big deal.
Sorry to get excited, but I just think you should. You own the gun, you're responsible, and you check it, and you double check it, and you just do that. That's just what you do.
That's
it's natural.
It works.
It's not
and
even.
I agree with that.
It's just natural. So,
when I was in middle school, I had a 16 gauge shotgun that was set up in the corner of my bedroom. You know, now they would come after my parents and take me away for them, you know, because that shotgun was just sitting there. And, you know, we'd go out and we'd shoot pheasant or rabbits or whatever during the fall. And, you know, we knew what we were doing. Nobody ever got killed.
I'll give you one better than that, Mark. My first handgun was a Trooper, Colt Trooper 357, which is a nice little weapon. I was 14 years old. I had a 22, I had a 30-30, I had a 12 gauge. We had a park across the street. That's where everybody got their ass kicked. That's where everybody fought. And you never for one second thought about running in the house and getting the gun.
Right.
Never even crossed your mind. It was I guarantee you, I got my face bloodied more than once. And that thought never crossed my mind. And we have a different society today. But I hate Alec Baldwin. I think that guy is a walking turd. And his interview, I can't stand the guy. And it would be nice to see him pay a penalty, but he's not going to. Nobody ever right. does. Those penalties are out there for Joe White trash like myself. And, you know, the big – there. No one's going to jail. He's not – even those people that were charged. But, you know, there does come a level of response. You know, all we hear about these bureaucrats wanting to take this gun. Oh, now the big thing is the ATF and their brace. What those dumb SOBs ought to worry about, don't worry about the short-barreled AR. You better worry about the 338 Lapua or the 550, the 50 caliber that's going to whack you at 500 meters. These guys, some of the stuff they worry about is unreal. So now you can put a brace on a 16-inch barrel, but before it was illegal, I don't know. We really need responsible people making gun rules and whatever, but I've said it.
Good luck with that. Cause we allow our bureaucrats to make those decisions.
Yeah, we do. And jackasses.
And for the most part, they're liberal and they don't, you know, if you work for ATF, you should at least know how a gun works.
Yeah. And you know, my point, Mark, on that was not that he should be held responsible in some way. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to see on the civil litigation that he's probably going to have,
I think it's already been settled.
Has it?
I think he already settled with her family, remember right.
I was going to say, you know, I mean, when it comes to the criminal aspect, I mean, you know it. Like, there's plenty of times that we have felt that charges should have been filed and they weren't, or there were times that a charge was filed and we're like, how do you know, mom, I accidentally fell asleep. She didn't purposely want to kill her daughter. You know, she's obviously going through a very difficult time. There's not any punishment that you could possibly give her, including charging her with, you know, criminal negligent homicide. She knows what she did. That's going to stick with her for the rest of her life. You know,
right. And I get that. I've never, because I think we handled two of those cases when I was a detective, and I never was like, you know, hey, we need to charge this person. Right. I get it. I wish we kind of had charged the one where they left their drugs out and their kids died, and we didn't charge them. At least I don't think we did. But in this case, all three were charged that handled mm-hmm. the gun.
Okay.
One's already pled guilty and is going to testify against the other two. That's typically, you know, we work for defense attorneys that, you know, the first, I always say the person who deals last gets the worst deal.
Yep.
And so one already ran and said, I'll take your deal. He'll probably get a little bit of time in jail, maybe 6 months or something. And then they're going to pressure her. She's going to capitulate. There's no way she can deal with this. So she's going to take a deal. And she says, I'll testify against Alec. You know, I've got no choice. And of course, she's out of the business, you know, once that happens. And then Alec Baldwin's going to have a tough time here from the standpoint is he's going to have two people testifying against him. And I'm pretty confident that his defense attorney, now this is what you always find at the beginning. And this is what you kind of hear when we move on to Idaho. After they file charges, the first thing you're going to hear from both sides, I mean, it's almost universal. You're going to hear the district attorney say, we have a rock solid case, boatloads of evidence showing that that person did that. Then you're going to have the defense attorney saying, oh, my client is looking forward to being adjudicated in court because there's their case against him is completely circumstantial and we're going to beat this at trial. Well, understand they're jockeying for deals. So when you hear yesterday, the DA who was on Fox say, we got a solid case, which they do. I mean, the evidence, he pointed the gun and shot her. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. And it was reckless what he did. And then he's saying, this is a complete abuse of the judicial system, blah, blah, blah. My client is as much a victim as what's, you know, whatever they say. They're jockeying for a deal. And my guess is there will be a deal struck and nobody's going to prison. That's my guess. Do you think that Alec Baldwin cares that he's a convicted felon? What does he care? He's not going to buy a gun anyway. So I think he just wants this to go away. So give it 6 months to a year because they're going to let this die down. And then all of a sudden, both sides are going to say, we came to an agreement to let the poor innocent victim or victims get closure. So we settled with Alec Baldwin and blah, blah. We think it's a good deal, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I think that's coming.
Right. And they'll get buy-in from the family, right? The family is going to say, look, we don't want to pursue this any further. And so let's just try and resolve this right now. You know,
yeah,
we're looking for prison time. We're looking for,
it's not going to happen.
I mean, I take accountability for what happened.
I don't think there's going to be prison time. I think they just want him to admit that what he did was he screwed up. Now here's a question. Mm-hmm. They said they spun the cylinder to show it was empty. I disagree with that, but I could be wrong, to show that it was empty because he's pointing that gun at the camera. That's the shot that they said they were looking for. And you see this all the time in movies that they'll show a brief 3 to 5 second, even if that one, probably 2 to 3 second clip of them pulling the gun and pulling the trigger. You see the flash and then they got to something else real quick. My understanding is that's what Alec Baldwin was doing. He was drawing his weapon and pointing it at the camera. So they want those cylinders full so they can see if somebody's watching the movie, they can see that all the chambers are filled with what looks like live rounds. That's why I'm saying they're using those dummy rounds that have lead, but there's no gunpowder in there. So that's my understanding. And if I'm wrong, I apologize. And also another thing that I heard, I got to say it that way, we're all kind of speculating, is that he had live rounds on his belt. You know, in these old gun belts, they have all these rounds around his belt, that all those were live rounds, or some of them were, intermixed with dummy rounds. Are you not asking for a problem? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's no doubt that there was serious negligence or incompetence behind all this. Now, is it going to serve any purpose putting them in prison? It would make me laugh. I would be entertained if Alec Baldwin went to jail for 6 months. I think maybe he should see how it's like on the inside. Hell, he'll probably just come out and do a movie or something. But he needs to be held responsible for what level of crime he committed. If it was negligent, then fine. Then that's what he needs to answer for. But it is what it is. So anything else on old Alec Baldwin? Buddy?
I'm sorry. I don't know a whole lot about the case. I heard about it months ago. You know, I think it happened sometime last year or late the year before.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Like 18 months or something ago.
And I knew it was on the set of a show, and that's all I knew. And a
movie,
the actual photographer, videographer, or producer was shot and killed. The lady that left behind a son and a husband, but that's
right.
All.
And there's really no reason. I would tell you this. There's no reason right now. There's no reason for someone to stand behind that camera. Right. They can move off to the side and use a digital flat screen to look at, to see what the camera is seeing. And so if by any fluke. I mean, obviously they should have made sure they were dummy rounds, but if there was any problems, you know, there's nobody behind. You might waste a $100,000 camera, but whatever, who cares?
Yeah.
But obviously there was negligence. I'm interested to see how this comes out. My prediction is they're going to cut a deal. Alec Baldwin is not going to go to trial. He's not going to risk it, but we'll see what happens. So I want to briefly talk about the missing person in Massachusetts, just real quick. And basically, are you familiar with Anna Walsh, who disappeared?
I am not.
All right, let me throw this out just for a minute. We'll move on to Idaho.
Okay.
This is one of the things I was saying. You can actually comment on this. If you do a random act of violence, which is kind of what we're looking at in Idaho, but we're learning now, maybe it's not as a random act of violence as we think it is.
Correct.
But if you're married to someone and you want to murder them, who do you think the prime suspect's going to be? So any idiot who thinks that they can do the perfect crime by murdering their wife, other than maybe O.J. Simpson, who got, I think, extremely lucky, it's just not going to happen. Because once they have a suspect, all these things start falling together. And that's how it's working in Idaho. Once they got a name, once they got a suspect, now they can look through all this digital evidence, social media, DNA, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And they're going to find where it equates to him. So this Walsh guy in Massachusetts is a flaming idiot. He needs to go away for the rest of his life. I feel sorry for his wife. We had a case here a couple of years ago, the Barrett case. Mm-hmm. Where he was the prime suspect and he got his girlfriend from Idaho, there's a connection, to come down and help him clean the crime scene. And they scrubbed this crime scene. They never found a body. This is kind of the comparison between the two. Never found a body. Well, guess what? You know, they successfully prosecuted him because with the, is it Luminol? Is that the right?
Yeah, Luminol.
You know, they sprayed it everywhere. Yep. They even found one of her teeth in the bathroom, like under the toilet. So as much as you want to clean a crime scene, you're going to leave something. Locard's principle is there for a reason. And now that they know that, I mean, Walsh was stupid.
Yeah. And I'm guessing, Mark, from what you're talking about, right? People always ask, why is that focus on the spouse? And it's pretty easy from an investigator's perspective of why we look at the spouse, because we typically look at what? Who is the last person to actually see this person alive, right? That's where you start your investigation. Normally, that last person to see that person alive happens to be, guess what? Somebody in the family. Typically, right. It's a spouse or boyfriend, right? Girlfriend, whoever it may be, could potentially be, a child. But that's where a criminal investigation typically begins. So if you have somebody who's missing, like in this case, you're explaining or talking about in Massachusetts, it'll be natural for investigators to look initially, right, at her spouse. Then what they're looking at is what? Now we're looking at what, is there any problems in their marriage? Are they going through any kind of financial problems? Is it known that one of them is having an affair? Is somebody, you know, stepping out of the marriage in some way? Had there been some talks about, you know, some kind of separation or potentially some kind of divorce? That's why a lot of this stuff ends up happening. I would probably tell you, when you're talking about a missing, you know, gal like the Kelsey Barrett case, it's natural for your investigation to focus towards, right, a husband or a boyfriend. It's just natural. And then what you're looking for is those little pieces of evidence, physical evidence, that ties right now the husband to the wife as being a suspect. What you got to be careful of is like things like DNA don't mean a whole lot because they live together.
They both live there.
But if we find high velocity blood stains or medium velocity blood stains, a bloody knife.
Luminol tells us a bunch.
Right. Now it changes the dynamics of the whole thing. We find out, hey, husband was having an affair. There's some communication of, hey, my wife will only be around for a little longer and then, you know, we'll be together forever type of thing. You know, like you said, we'll be looking at social media. We'll be looking at their phone. We'll be looking at their computers. We'll be looking at everything, interviewing witnesses, interviewing neighbors, interviewing coworkers, trying to find out exactly, right, what was this marriage like? And then you'll find out quickly from all of that whether your focus still should be on the spouse, right? Or is there somebody else that, you know, is it a random individual? Or is it somebody else that's, you know, closely connected to this gal? Like maybe she was the one having an affair. And maybe she told this guy, hey, I don't want to be with you anymore. I'm going to stay with my husband. And he's like, well, if I can't have you, nobody's going to have you. And so, you know, he takes her. We don't know that, but you're not going to know it until you actually go through the investigation and start to really find out a lot more about their life.
Yeah. Right. And that's what you do is you walk in their footsteps and you figure out that's why digital evidence or digital forensics, as we call it, is so important because people live their lives on their cell phones. And if you can get your hand on their cell phones and their call detail records, their cell phone records, you can pretty much trace their life.
And if it's not call detail records, right? It's geolocation material. Yep. Like, you know, did they have their Google Maps and timeline on where it's showing specific data points of where they possibly are located? Are they using Snapchat or Instagram to take a picture of themselves? And now we have potentially a lat long of where that photograph was taken. There's a lot of things that we can absolutely learn from the digital evidence.
And that's exactly right. So kind of transitioning over to Idaho, which is becoming less interesting to me at this point, because it sounds like a lot of this stuff are lined up. And you actually do in this case as well, just like in the Baldwin case, the prosecutor says we have tons of evidence. And then the defense attorney says, oh, there's all kinds of holes in their case. I just ignore all that. Wait for a year. You know, all this stuff's going to come out. And, you know, I find this stuff interesting that is coming out that he may have visited their restaurant. He's vegan. And he goes to a restaurant that specializes in lamb or sheep.
It was a Greek store.
I mean, that makes no sense.
It was the Mad Greek restaurant in Moscow, Idaho.
Yeah. Why is he going there if he's vegan? It makes no sense whatsoever. It appears, and I say that because I've seen in some cases, and I know you have too, where the prosecutors will say we have a wealth of information. And then when we do the CDR analysis, it's like, you got one phone record, dude. You don't have that much. And so I would, if I was working this case for the defense, I want to see all that information. I want to see their geofence. I want to see if I'm sure they did cell tower dumps. I want to see the CDRs. I want to see the Cellebrite download. And then the social media now, which is what's popping up now. The question is, why are we hearing about this?
Right.
You know, we shouldn't be hearing about any of this.
Yeah.
Now they have to submit their PC affidavits. And some people are like, man, it just doesn't seem like there's tons of information in there. Well, as a prosecutor, I don't want to lay everything out for the public. I want to give enough out there that a judge is going to sign a warrant and say, yes, you have probable cause for trial. And then I'm going to start building my case. And then in discovery, I'm going to provide that information to the defense and not to the public. One of the first things that always takes place, and it has in this case as well, is the judge gives out a gag order. You know, because we don't want to fight this out on social media, because they need to constantly be thinking, we're going to need a trial. You know, we're going to need a jury for this trial potentially in a year or two. So if everybody knows everything about everything, they're all going to have preconceived notions. They're going to come in and say, oh, I've already read all that on social media, and they're going to get excluded. So you can't find an unbiased jury.
Right.
So that's why they do these gag orders. I'm good with it. You know, I've seen enough, to be honest with you, from that case. I think it's going to play out in the courts. I'm interested to see if he's the psychopath that they kind of make him out to be, or what the deal is. I actually still train individuals that want to go into law enforcement, and occasionally, very rarely, I think in the 15 or 17 years that I've been teaching, I had one guy that after he graduated from our class and before he got hired by law enforcement, was doing traffic stops in his own car. And he actually bought an old cruiser, which they sell, you know, and let me tell you one thing. If I can give you some facts on your life, don't ever buy a used rental car. And for goodness sakes, don't ever buy an old police cruiser unless you want to enter it into a demolition derby a week or two later, because they're trash. Cops, you know, after a long period of time, I don't care how much maintenance they've had, those cars are beat down, but he's going out doing traffic stops. So thank goodness that he was caught before he became an actual cop, because no telling if he's willing to do that, this is not somebody you want in law enforcement. So this individual, and I always have a pet peeve about people becoming experts or highly educated in criminal justice or criminology, and they've never worked the industry. They'll go get a PhD and it's like, hey, I've got a PhD in criminology. Yeah. Okay. What have you done? You know, what cases have you worked on? So, but anything else about Idaho that you can think of?
You know, this, it's an interesting case. And, you know, when I was teaching last semester at the university, you know, this came up towards the latter part. I think the case came up just right before Thanksgiving, but, you know, the students were asking me, you know, what do you think is going on? And I said, you know, bottom line, this is not some random act of violence. I didn't think it was. And the reason why I didn't think it was a random act of violence is who just walks into a home, right, and just kills four people without knowing, number one, doing any kind of canvassing, right, doing any kind of layout of the interior or knowing who lives in there. Heck, you, there might be five guys, six guys, eight guys, 10 guys, 10 people, who knows, a bunch of guns. We don't know what, right, what we're walking into. So the fact that it's random and there's four people that died is a highly unlikely scenario. And right, I said, the other thing that I would tell you is I believe that that individual is going to live somewhere in that vicinity. It's not somebody who just happened to be strolling by Idaho on a particular evening, right? And just decided, hey, I think this is a great time to go in and kill a bunch of people. I said, somebody close by, there's got to be a connection between whoever did the murder. If it's more than one, we don't know at this time, but whoever did the murder and these victims, there has to be a connection. And what's interesting, Mark, is what's unfolding now is that they're finding out that there was, you know, this restaurant visit, right? Right. There was, apparently Instagram. There was some ties to Instagram. Exactly. Yep. So I, you know, IG is, as the kids would say, what's your IG? There's apparently some connection between potentially one or as many as three of the female victims and this guy, Brian Kohlberger. So, you know, there's going to be a connection, which goes back to, right, from an investigative standpoint, what would we be looking at? We'd be looking obviously really hard and heavy at his cell phone. They took a computer tower when they actually executed a warrant on his apartment. The other thing that was interesting is that they came up with a bunch of hair strands. They came up with some animal hair, but no weapon. And you know, people are always concerned, like, what if they don't ever find the murder weapon? You know, they still can develop a very strong case. Here's the thing. If any of that hair happens to match, you know, that, you know, Miss Kangalvis, Kaylee or Mogan or Kernodal, if any of their hair, or even this kid, the boyfriend, Chapin or Chapin, if any one of their hair happens to be in this Brian Kohlberger's home, there is no innocent explanation for that. Unless Kohlberger had a party and all four of them happened to be in there in his home at some
point. Car.
I'm sorry?
His car. I'm sure they're going to go
his car.
They're going, right, to take his car apart piece by piece.
His clothing, I would tell you, on a stabbing involving four people, it's impossible for you not to have blood on you.
And the thing that it's I found impossible. From experience, they will burn or get rid of their clothes, but they keep their shoes.
Their shoes. And the shoes
always go for the shoes.
And the shoes are the things that contain some great evidence. Always.
Gravity brings that blood down. And they said something about a footprint. And
that's right. They do. They have one with a diamond, I believe, yeah, is how they describe it. Maybe a possibly a Van type of shoe. But yeah, I don't know if you remember, Mark, the murder we did up the pass involving two victims. And what happened was two kids, Paprocki and Ivy, if you remember, they went in, two kids, decided they were going to kill Afflin and Dahl in their home in Cristola. And the way, one of the ways of one of the pieces of evidence in that was one of the boys that actually kicked one of the doors where one of the victims, right, were found. And by kicking that door, we were able to get, actually, it was a Van and an Adidas shoe that we found. It was also, one of them stepped on a piece of paper. And so we were able to get a shoe wear impression from that, know what kind of shoe it was. And then when we actually found them at a tent site in Larkspur, if you remember, the tent, yep, had an Adidas and a Van shoe. And so we were able to tie their shoes to the crime scene. And then eventually we were actually, you know, we were able to tie other pieces of evidence. But that, you, right, know, this place is going to play out quite similar. They're going to find some physical evidence either in his car, on his clothing, in his house, right?
If they find it in his
potentially
apartment.
At his parents' house.
Yeah, if they find it in his apartment, because, I mean, here's the deal. And someone's asking, why do they keep their shoes? People love their shoes. They go, mm-hmm, out and they spend big money on shoes. They take a quick look and they're like, oh, they're cleaner. They'll try to clean them. We hit them with luminol and we get blood, you know, or they soak into a lot of it if it's leather or cloth or whatever. So shoes are just worth their weight in gold. if he, after he's done killing these people, and I know we only got a couple minutes here, John, he could not have gotten in his car and not transferred DNA, blood.
Oh, yeah. You're going to see things on the pedal. You're going to see stuff on the floor mat. But the other reason why people don't get rid of their shoes is it's not an organized homicide. It's a disorganized homicide. So what happens is, in their rush to try and remember all the things that they need to get rid of, they think of only the things like their shirt, right? Their pants, their jacket, right? Maybe a ball cap or the knife in this case, right? But what they're not thinking about is, oh, wait, I only have, you know, a pair of shoes. That couldn't possibly have anything on it. But the reality is there's probably some close ties to that Hyundai Elantra that he was driving. You're probably going to find some good physical evidence in there as well.
I would think so. I mean, that's what I would be interested in. But all right, so we've exhausted our time.
Okay.
And I'm pretty exhausted as well.
Get better. You sound sick.
I am like, you know, my wife won't come near me. She thinks I have COVID. And I told her if I'm still not feeling well in the morning, I'll take one of her stupid COVID tests. I think I'm fine. I'm just worn down. And you know this, John, you've flown around and testified in other cases. It is a draw to get up on a stand in front of a judge and testify for multiple hours.
Yep.
It just really wears on you. So I'm tired. I'm going to chill all weekend.
Please do.
Stuff. I should be fine by Monday. Everyone else, again, make sure you tell Chuck and Julie how much of a great job that I did, even if you don't think I did. What do they always say? If I did a bad job, tell me. If I did a great job, tell Chuck and Julie. But I love listening to their show. So you guys have a great weekend. We live in one of the best states for weather and for, well, I shouldn't be saying that now. But all right, everybody have a great weekend, and I'll see you guys in the future.
Take care.